Teaching is our passion. We at The Wall Street Skinny are proud to announce that we've joined the advisory board for the iConnections Funds for Teachers initiative, focused on supporting the Ron Clark Academy and its pioneering teaching methods. Through Funds for Teachers, iConnections is dedicated to empowering educators nationwide by providing access to RCA's professional development opportunities. Events are being organized in major cities throughout the year to fundraise and support this incredibly important cause. All proceeds from these events will be directly donated to the Ron Clark Academy, specifically to financially aid teachers so they can participate in RCA's groundbreaking training programs. Please click on the link in our show notes to register for an event in the city nearest you. This is The Wall Street Skinny, a podcast devoted to exploring the financial services industry and making the world of Wall Street accessible to everyone. Hi, friends. Welcome back to The Wall Street Skinny. I'm Jen.
I'm Kristen.
And we are two lifelong friends. This is the fastest growing female finance podcast where we give you the skinny on the world's most confusing concepts and answer all of the questions you've always had about finance, but have been too afraid to ask. So this is part two in our intro to crypto series, where we are bringing back our dear friend, Chris Newhouse, who talked about Bitcoin being at all-time highs last week. Today, we're going to get into more detail about digital currencies. We're going to talk about how layer one and layer two ecosystems have evolved. And if you have no idea what that is, we're going to explain that in more detail. We're going to talk about what career paths look like in the crypto space for young people breaking into the industry or for traditional finance practitioners who are trying to break out of that and into crypto. And we're here to ask the question of whether or not real life crypto traders bear any resemblance to the absolutely wild stuff you see on social media.
Yes. And I think the other thing that was so cool about this conversation is that Chris, who we're talking to, he was able to break into finance through crypto despite, and he'll come right out and tell you, like, he did not have sort of your traditional good GPA, but like is actually like a go-to resource for the traditional media when they need to have someone talk about crypto on like Bloomberg. He's been on TV with Yahoo Finance. And so I think what's so interesting about his story is just that so many people are like stampeding. It's like a herd and always going like, oh, I need to go into this thing, the most prestigious thing that's going to like set me up for all these other things. He decided to go a different route and he's able to kind of get in on the ground floor into this new space. So it's just going to be a really great conversation.
I loved talking to Chris, and we'll definitely have him back on again in the future as well. But before we get into that, happy Three Body Problem Day to Yay! All who celebrate. And if you have no idea what we're talking about, we rarely get into like book recommendations. I feel like we tried to pilot something on one episode where we were like, let's give our Wall Street Skinny recommends, blah, blah, blah. And that went absolutely nowhere. So if you ever listen to that episode and cringe, now you'll know why. But one of the favorite books that I read a couple of years ago was the Three Body Problem series. And I forced poor Kristen to read it as a result and a couple of my other friends. It's great. It's absolutely fantastic. It's sci-fi. And the creators of Game of Thrones, this is not like a paid ad or anything, by the way. I just realized it. Like, this totally sounds like a paid ad. It's not. But Netflix better pay us. Anyways, the guys who did Game of Thrones are releasing their version of it on Netflix and it premieres tonight. And I'm so excited, except I'm not going to watch it until tomorrow because I promised Laura I'd watch it with her and she's coming back to Charlotte today.
Really?
But, yes, I know. So I'll hopefully try to hold off. It's funny because there is the Chinese version that I tried to watch.
You told me how you like pirated it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's now on Peacock. But the problem is it's boring. Like it's really slow. So I've been trying to make my husband watch it. And we have tried three times to make it through the first episode and he has fallen asleep every single time. So I've just given up. I was like, I'll wait for the Netflix series to come out.
Do you know if it's going to be, because it was interesting in some of the previews, it almost looks like, and I have not read the second book. So it's like a three part.
It's only the first book. I can tell it's only the first book.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, because there is the, I need to, and I actually, I have an Audible, my Dark Forest, like I gotta listen to that now. to get ready. I think that once I start watching it, I'm going to get back into it. Cause it's one of those things where I feel like you always going to need to be in a mood for something. And it's
Once
I'm sucked in, you're sucked in. Like, and with Three Body Problem, I finished it in the course of like a few days. Yeah. And I know that's going to happen with this, but like, it's taking me a little bit of time to kind of get.
And the beginning of The Dark Forest is not great. It is a slow burn. It took me a long time to get into The Dark Forest. I would argue it might be the best of the three books.
You told me that. So I'm actually really excited to listen.
Yeah. And then third one is a hot mess, but you still got to do it. And you got to power through it. There's like a 150-page long fairy tale. Like, oof, there's some parts. But it's worth it. Just the whole experience is worth it. There's nothing else like it. It's such a cool experience reading that series.
I was laughing because I had called Jen, or I think I messaged you, and I was like, I'm now watching a 52-part TikTok series with this woman named Risa Tisa, who married a pathological liar. And this is, I mean, how many minutes? 10 times 62, 520 minutes. And she has like 28 million views. This is insane. God. I mean, this is probably getting more reach than like a proper Netflix show. She's like literally driving in her car recording herself, but it's funny.
Like, I was like, this seems dangerous.
It's definitely dangerous, but she, I think, was invited to South by Southwest and actually had a proper ad for Three Body Problem. And I was like, but it's actually like a great story. I mean, this poor woman, I mean, she's going to now like, she's set for life. She is going to be dragged into reality TV shows. I mean, congrats to her.
Well, what's funny too is now that Kristen has, I watched the summary.
You watched the summary.
I did not have the patience for 52 TikTok videos. I can barely make it through one of our own.
Like,
this guy, the moral of the story for anyone who's not familiar with Who the F Did I Marry is that this woman was in a relationship with someone who was a pathological liar to the extent that he was pretending to take phone calls in his earbuds for hours on hours of the day when there was no one on the other end of the line. He was falsifying purchase contracts on houses and they were out shopping for appliances when there was no contract on the house.
The part that's like the craziest, what's so weird with pathological liars is they're not lying for a reason. So it's
there's
like
no benefit.
He would make up siblings. And he made up that he had a younger brother when it was really a twin who was old. Like, the whole thing is just like wild. And so,
the problem is now whenever we see or hear anything, Kristen's like, this is an imposter. Like, I don't think this person's real. I think they're lying to us. And I'm like, Kristen, it's the UPS driver. Like,
well, it is crazy. I'm curious, like, how many people are actually in the world like this? But again, it was
just, it's a non-zero amount. I told you a story of a dear friend who was dating a guy who had like a secret family, you know? I mean, I always joke, if my husband's listening to this, if you have a secret family, I'm honestly more impressed at this point than I am mad, just because where do you find the time?
So anyway, so I know this is a long episode, so we'll shut up and we'll bring Chris on. But when we report back next time, we'll have Three Body Problem that we can talk
about. We'll have our review. Exactly. Okay. Well, guys, we are joined by Chris Newhouse today. And this is the podcast episode that was the most fun to source a guest for because we met Chris through TikTok. And most of you know by now that Kristen had to drag me kicking and screaming onto TikTok. I was like, this is the poison of today's generation. All there is trolls. And this commenter comes out of the blue. Crypto trader. What is it? Crypto trader 123 or 321? Yeah. I don't even know.
I forgot as well.
Yeah.
321.
So,
321.
Crypto trader 321 asking the most insightful, thoughtful, kind questions on our posts. I would post like, here's how you do an interest rate swap. And Crypto Trader 321 would be like, can you help me understand the hedging implications for corporations? And I was like, oh my gosh, there's hope for society. And we would always get so excited when Crypto Trader would ask a question. Full disclosure, Chris, I actually thought you were a woman just because you have like this very kind, respectful energy.
Yeah.
Kristen's much better at determining the sex of our commenters. Once we migrated over to Instagram, we got a DM and it was from a gentleman named Chris Newhouse. And he was like, hi, I'm Crypto Trader 321. And I swear to God, seeing your face, I was like, it's like finding out Batman's true identity. This is amazing. It was the most exciting thing. And, you know, for all we knew, Chris, you were just some casual, and we'll get into this, keyboard jockey trading crypto in your spare time. We come to find out that you are this incredibly knowledgeable, well-established trader in the field who's had a great career thus far. You've just started a new step in your career and you've been on multiple different platforms to discuss digital currencies like Bloomberg and things like that. So I'd love it if you could introduce yourself, talk a little bit about your bio, how you got into the space, and give us the download on crypto.
I'd be happy to. And first of all, you know, I'm a big fan of your guys' podcast and also the TikToks. I think it resonated with me because I think I'm part of the audience that you guys were targeting, right? Kind of like the just came into college, early stage career, like there's still opportunities for people to learn, but there's also opportunities for people to find out what buy side recruitment looks like, what sell side recruitment looks like, what popular interview questions might be like. So I think I just resonated immediately because I was like, oh, you know, this podcast seems like it's fit for early stage career, but also those new entrants in college. So like the first thing I did was as soon as I found this, you know, a year ago, I think I followed you on TikTok whenever you guys had like hundreds of followers on TikTok. but I was a follower and I sent it to a couple of my friends. One of my friends, she's going into a sales and trading role this summer and she's a big fan of your podcast as well. And I sent it to a couple of friends. So I was like, oh, this is great. But yeah, you know, to kind of kick it off and talk a little bit more about my background. So I graduated Georgia Tech with a degree in biology. So very non-traditional background. My GPA was not very good. I still ended up getting these opportunities. So happy to talk a little bit more about that as well. At Georgia Tech, so I started our quantitative trading club. It's got around 400 plus members now. It's sponsored by Citadel, IMC, a bunch of different other trading firms. Co-founded our blockchain club as well, which has over 350 members. So a lot of students who are very interested in the space have joined that club. It's focused a lot on kind of research and just, you know, raising awareness of the opportunities in blockchain and crypto. And then I was also on the founding executive team of our venture capital club. So anything to do with finance, anything to do with crypto, very active in the university space there. But like I said, I had a very non-traditional background. So my GPA was not very good. It was a 2.8, which never went on my resume ever.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to find out too how you got away with not putting that on your resume because a lot of our community will be like, my GPA sucks. What's going to happen? And mine was like a 3.4, 3.5 or something like that. And I used to get asked in interviews, why is your GPA so low? So 2.8 is a lot to get away with. I'm impressed.
No, obviously the reason people care about GPA is because it shows your work ethic. It shows that you're able to put in the time and diligence to do something maybe that you don't want to do. But for me, I was able to kind of like spin the story and say that, hey, you know, this doesn't, well, first of all, they never asked about it. So I was very lucky there. But also it just depends on the opportunities. So there's probably a 0% chance I would have ended up at a bulge bracket bank or a big consulting firm just because the recruiting process is so structured. The question about GPA is definitely going to come up. And if it's not on your resume, they're going to ask like, what's wrong with you? But for crypto, it was a unique opportunity for me and also for trading, actually, because a couple of the trading internships that I had applied for and received full-time offers for as well, they didn't ask for the GPAs. But I think I was able to spin the story that, you know, my passion for the space, my interest in finance and my work ethic were actually defined a lot more by my extracurricular activities on campus. I had started all three of these clubs. Now they're sponsored by massive players in the industry.
Yeah.
And I think I was able to kind of spin that off and just say that that was a little bit more defining than, you know, maybe my anatomy or physiology class, which is already completely unrelated to finance.
I was going to say, I mean, like studying biology, you almost get a little bit of a pass, I think, if you have some of the harder courses. But I actually wonder too, I mean, how much of it is, do you think because crypto was a newer asset class? I mean, down the road, I feel like I can see the recruiting getting so much more structured. But like right now, it just feels like it's this massive opportunity. It reminds me kind of like these traders who just like start in the mailroom at Morgan Stanley and then like become the CEO. It's sort of kind of in line with that.
Yeah. I think that that is definitely a massive thing. Well, also quick side note, that's one of the reasons I got into crypto was because I realized that not only is this a new industry, but I had the opportunity to get in at the ground floor of institutional adoption with some of the most reputable firms in the space. So I was like, oh, I'm getting into crypto at the Goldman of crypto right now, and they're just building it out. I felt like I was like a software engineer in the early 2000s. Yeah. The thought leaders in the space right now, they're, you know, 25, 28, 29, 32. Whereas the thought leaders in traditional finance, they've had 20 plus years of trading the markets. So for me, going into crypto, it was an opportunity to not be analyst number one of 52 at Goldman or JP Morgan or something like that. It was an opportunity for me to carve my own path and just be Chris Newhouse. I didn't have to be, you know, analyst one of 50 and have to, you know, spend 2 years analyst, 2 years associate, oh, then 3 years VP. crypto is like very meritocratic and it is very unstructured, which is also why I like the environment, because it's like, if I do really well, then, you know, exponential career path there. So whenever I was recruiting for internships and getting into crypto, this was 2021. But as we all know, like there's no major that defines crypto or blockchain. Yeah. There's no like hard skills immediately that you'd get from a university degree that could be applied to the space right off the bat. Obviously, they would love to have STEM majors. So CS and math, that's cool. Cryptography, obviously, it's in the name as well. Mm-hmm. But going through the interview process, and these were multiple rounds, multiple stages. My first internship was at Genesis Trading. So it was the largest OTC derivatives desk in crypto, largest crypto lending business. This was a very serious firm started by, you know, people in traditional finance. They've been around since 2013. I mean, for my Genesis internship, this was 6 to 7 rounds. For my GSR full-time, this was 5 to 6 rounds. But they really focused a lot more on just your knowledge of the space. They were very interested in what you knew about DeFi. It is really cool to see how the questions evolved from 2021 recruiting to 2022 and 2023, once it started to get a little bit more mainstream. The kind of questions I was getting asked in 2021 was like, oh, you know, what do you think about the price of Bitcoin in a couple of years? What do you think drives the value of Bitcoin? Have you ever yield farmed? So it's a DeFi specific term. Are you familiar with the term NFTs? It was more like, how familiar are you with the space?
What is DeFi?
Yeah. So decentralized finance. And it's kind of like a subsection of crypto that really focuses on lending, borrowing, trading, and doing it all decentralized rather than having to go through a centralized entity like a bank or someone who can kind of control the rates and control the currencies. And we'll talk about this as well in crypto whenever we define crypto. The biggest thing that separates crypto from just traditional finance is that decentralized ethos of crypto. Everything is decentralized. Nobody's, you know, turning on the money printer and printing more Bitcoin because it's mathematically not possible.
So it's like, mm-hmm. whatever, 2020, and you have a massive crash, nobody's going to be piling money. Like the Federal Reserve's not just printing money.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, there's no Federal Reserve for Bitcoin. It's mm-hmm. just all there mathematically. The big thing about 2021 was they wanted you to be a generalist. They wanted you to know a little bit about a lot of things, to be able to discuss a lot of different things in crypto, whether that is the regulatory aspect of it, what DeFi is, NFTs. It was a really big advantage to be a generalist. As you start to see a lot of these roles fill up, and a lot of these early stage career roles actually just filled up with people from traditional finance who had 2 years of experience in IB or S&T or consulting, being a generalist didn't really help as much because now people are starting to hire for specific roles. They're starting to hire for OTC derivative sales trader. They're starting to hire for, you know, MEV engineer. They're starting to hire for a lot more specific and tailored roles.
Sorry for our listeners. Again, we've touched on the term OTC before, but if anyone's listening in for the first time, OTC stands for over the counter, meaning not something that's exchange traded, like typical futures and commodities that you might see trading on the CBOT or things like the Chicago Board of Trade or things like that, to not even abbreviate myself. And then what is MEV?
Yes. So that it's a very crypto native topic. It's maximal extractable value. And that's something that would probably be better explained by Google. It gets very, very technical and it goes into the deep depths of what the Ethereum mempool looks like. It's a very technical topic, but essentially these kind of engineers are focused on reordering the transactions, how they're settled on Ethereum. And it's very interesting, but it's a very technical topic. And actually, I probably can't explain it simply. I honestly might not even be able to explain it complexly as well.
Totally fine. And this is great. You were talking about the difference between generalists and specialists. Sorry.
Yeah. So you could definitely see that evolution go from 2021 to 2022 and 2023. Also a big factor that this plays into early stage career recruiting as well, from what I've seen. In 2021, this was a couple of years after a very large institutional move into the space. 2017, 2018, 2020, you started to see a lot more institutions get in the space. You started to see JP Morgan open up their Onyx division. You started to see BNY Mellon start focusing on custody and offering solutions for, you know, storing Bitcoin there. You started to see BitGo and all these qualified custodians open things up as well. So 2021, this was right after a very large institutional focused wave. 2017, we could probably define as a more retail driven wave. The big ICO bubble in 2017, December, you saw like all these tokens just going crazy and taking off and crashing and things like that.
That's
definitely more of a
ICO.
Oh, my bad. Yeah. Initial coin offering. Kind of like IPO.
It's an ICO.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So they've got these ICOs where all these tokens are starting to launch and they have these liquidity events. They call it a TGE, token generating event. So there's a bunch of different things that are just analogous to traditional finance, but now they're happening in crypto.
It's so funny because this is almost like a great gut check to feel again what it's like to be someone on the outside of a super jargonized industry, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you use more acronyms that I hadn't heard before in a 5-minute stretch. And this must be what it feels like when you're sitting in a bar with your friends in finance and they're like, the CDO, CLO, blah, 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 you know, like.
We
made a commitment early on in this podcast to never use an acronym without defining it. I think we've stayed pretty true to that. So this is going to be a tough episode for you because you have to put yourself in our shoes. And
now I know what my fiance must feel like whenever I'm explaining, oh yeah, ICO, IEO, IDO. And I'm like, all right, yeah, there's three different IEO.
What's an IEO?
So that would be an initial DEX offering, and a DEX is a decentralized exchange. So that is another a DeFi term.
I should turn off my camera and just put like a brain exploding emoji up as my avatar for this entire podcast because I don't think my face adequately.
A decentralized index.
Kind of like Coinbase, but fully decentralized. Like the big thesis in crypto that everyone says is not your keys, not your coins. And that refers to the private keys of your crypto wallets. So if you create a crypto wallet, you own these private keys, which gives you access to your wallet. If you lose your wallet, you own the keys, you wrote them down and all this stuff, you can get it back. But they're basically saying, that's actually a great point.
In like 2020, where there was like some guy who like had tried like 4 out of his 10 password tries. And was like living and dying because he had 6 tries left and couldn't remember it and had millions of dollars locked up.
Exactly like you're saying, he forgot his keys and he pretty much just gave up. He was like, all right, they're like, I'm never getting this. There's $10 million on this hard drive. But this is the pros and cons of centralization and decentralization, right? If this was centralized, maybe I just go to the help desk and be like, oh, here's my social security number that I signed up with, blah, blah, blah. Please give me back my $10 million. There's nobody you go to in crypto to get that back. It's a huge thing in crypto, not your keys, not your coins. These decentralized exchanges, you own the private keys to your wallet, you just connect to these decentralized exchange and trade, blah, blah, blah. But whenever you're spinning up a wallet on Kraken or Coinbase or Binance, they have your private keys for that wallet. So it's actually less secure to be stored. And it makes sense, right? We'll go into the FTX stuff. If you kept all your stuff on exchange and they blow up, you're screwed, right? So, you know, keeping it off exchange, all this stuff, we can get into it, the custody and all that. It's a very fascinating topic as well, but yeah.
Woo! Okay. So maybe we should back up like 8,000 steps and do a very brief, if we can, 10,000 foot view of what are cryptocurrencies. I'd love if you could just give our users a good working definition to be the premise on which we can build for this episode.
Yep. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I'd say that digital currencies are very technology centric. They revolve around a couple of core ideas. And if you understand these ideas and why these ideas are important for cryptocurrencies, then you'll understand why they exist. So the two core ideas I'd say are decentralization and transparency. So in my definition, I'd say that cryptocurrencies are a digital currency in which the transactions are verified and recorded on a decentralized ledger. So you can access every past transaction that's ever gone through Bitcoin or Ethereum, and they're unable to be modified or altered by centralized authorities. So you see the transactions, you can't modify them, you can't change them, you can't change anything about it, you can't reroute them, you can't do any of that. There's nobody who controls the Bitcoin network that can just print more Bitcoin. There's no Fed for Bitcoin. And then also there's a lot of different cryptocurrencies. So there's Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana. And then there are tokens within the ecosystems of some of these larger networks that can provide governance or give you trading fees and other tangible benefits as to why you'd own them.
Sorry, really quickly. So when you say there's cryptocurrencies versus tokens, what's the difference between those two things?
So from my perspective, the cryptocurrencies are going to be, it's using actually another jargon word. There's these layer one networks, which Ethereum would be or Solana would be. Bitcoin, there's not really too much activity in the decentralized application space. So Bitcoin exists, and the core use case for Bitcoin is as a digital currency. People have always been pitching Bitcoin as, oh, you know, digital gold or something like that, store of value. Or people pitch Bitcoin of, hey, you know, one day in the future, we might actually, you know, exchange Bitcoin for a car instead of trading a US dollar or something like that. The main use case for Bitcoin has always been currency centric. Whereas the main use case for something like Ethereum, which came out later, is it's very, very technology centric, and it is using cryptography and it's using computer science to build applications on top of Ethereum that are decentralized. And I'm trying to think of a good way to put this analogously to like a phone. You have Solana and Ethereum. They're both layer ones where you can build decentralized applications. This would be the equivalent of the iPhone and the Android. So let's say Ethereum is the iPhone, Solana is the Android. And then once you're like actually, you know, using your iPhone, you have apps on your phone. And now let's just say while you're using these apps, you need to pay or make a transaction. Well, that is where if you're using the iPhone equivalent to Ethereum, you'd be using Ethereum to pay for these transactions. Whereas if you had the Android phone, which is Solana, you would be using Solana to pay for the transactions on those apps. So that is kind of like the difference between what you would say is like Bitcoin versus these different layer one coins. And then now let's get even deeper. If you look at each individual app on those phones, that could maybe be a token. And that might be like a specific app or a specific use case for that decentralized application. Let's just say it's an exchange. So that's a very common one, a decentralized exchange, kind of like a Robinhood or a Coinbase or something to like trade back and forth. You might have a token, which is kind of like the currency for that specific application. Whenever people trade Solana, the layer one, they're taking a bet on the entire Solana ecosystem. Yeah. But whenever you see them trade these specific tokens, they're taking a specific bet on a part of that ecosystem taking off. So if there's three decentralized exchange tokens, and we'll talk about it later with the different trading strategies, relative value and all that, you start being able to get very isolated access to what you think is going to win in crypto. And it's very interesting from a trading perspective.
So quick question. So this is going to sound really dumb. As a layperson who's never bought crypto, I now buy Ethereum. How do I now get access to like the next level? Like,
yeah, to use everything. Yeah, exactly.
How do I level up?
Yep. Yeah. So I went through like a walkthrough with a couple of my friends actually. So as soon as you buy the Ethereum, now you can start using the decentralized applications now that you own the Ethereum. Coinbase actually has a Coinbase wallet that you can have in your browser, and you can actually connect that wallet to all the different, you know, decentralized applications. You can pull off the Ethereum and move it somewhere else. So there's dozens, hundreds of decentralized applications built on top of the Ethereum network. And that's just another thing that you'll see in crypto. All the information is out there, but it's very difficult to figure out, you know, what is important to look at. It's difficult to filter the signal from the noise. Like all the information is out there, but it's hard to figure out a lot of this stuff. So to kind of add a little bit more transparency, there's a website called DeFi Llama. DeFi and then LLAMA, like literally the animal. And it shows a bunch of the different DeFi applications that have been built across these layer ones. Once you get that Ethereum, like you're talking about, Kristen, you'll go to like one of these websites. One of the biggest decentralized applications is actually a lending and borrowing platform called Aave. So what you would do is you literally just go to the Aave website, you connect your Coinbase wallet, and now you have this kind of open source liquidity protocol where you can earn interest. It's literally lending and borrowing, decentralized application, DeFi. There's nobody on the other end of this in terms of a centralized intermediary or anything like that. It is purely computer science and cryptography that runs this protocol. I'm literally just looking at it right now. You launch the app, you connect your wallet, and mathematically, there's all these different ways that they've calculated what the lending and borrowing rate should be. So what happens is...
Fed funds?
So some of this actually gets tied to real world benchmarks just because there would be an arbitrage opportunity if there wasn't. So some of the real world benchmarks do get integrated just naturally. Because if people are like, oh, I could just, you know, go borrow somewhere else and get better rates and not have to deal with the risk of these decentralized applications, which we can talk about as well, you know, everything blowing up and stuff.
Which makes total sense. And I just want to like back it up for the people who like are studying the traditional finance, because I mean, I feel like it's not a carry trade, but if you think about the futures for oil, right? If you were able to borrow money, buy oil today, and then you have to store it, the storage costs, the borrowing costs, like all feeds into this price that you can buy in the future, because otherwise, to your point, there'd be an arbitrage opportunity. The real world has to kind of play a part, right? The real world financing costs and everything do kind of trickle into this other like alternative universe, which literally feels like crypto feels like the upside down. It's like a totally different world.
Yeah, especially once you start diving into these decentralized applications, like the easy one to understand is, oh, you know, Bitcoin, we want to use it as a currency in the future. We can trade back and forth, digital gold. But then once you start getting into the decentralized applications and how I'm just explaining this lending and borrowing platform, it's super cool. And how you would use it is, okay, you deposit your ETH here and you earn a yield back in stable coins. And those stable coins.
Yeah, what is a stable coin?
Yep. So the stable coins like USDT, which is called Tether, and USDC, which is Coinbase or Circle's stable coin, which is fully backed one-to-one by cash and cash equivalents. These stable coins are how you kind of get your dollar into DeFi. This is how you bridge into DeFi. Very similar to like how you talked about, you know, using ETH to get into DeFi. You can use the stable coins to get into DeFi as well. You know, if you go on Coinbase, you'll see like, oh, what is USDT and why is it always $1? Well, that's the stable coin Tether. And once you actually buy the Tether on Coinbase, you realize, oh, I can move Tether to some of these DeFi protocols as well. And I don't have to just move Ethereum. So yeah, that kind of covers DeFi. So your question of how to get around and play with it. So first, you actually have to understand what apps are out there. And that's just a skill in and of itself. But DeFi Llama, it's got a bunch of the different decentralized applications that are built on Ethereum. So it'd be like, oh, what is Eigenlayer or what is Maker or Aave's on here is number three. What is Uniswap? Uniswap is the decentralized exchange and all that. Yeah.
Which one is the coolest?
the coolest one would probably, from my perspective, be Uniswap. So it's a decentralized exchange, but it is not an exchange like you and I would think, right? It is not. This is another very crypto native new primitive called the automated market maker. I'll back up. And this is something you guys have probably talked about and everyone's familiar with. The central limit order book. We can put up a bid.
We haven't talked about it here.
Yeah. So you can put up a bid. You can put up an offer. You know, if the bids and offers match, a trade happens, there's a matching system that goes through. This is what an exchange looks like, right? So whenever, you know, the viewers kind of put on, you know, hey, I'm willing to buy Apple shares for 150, but I want to buy them specifically at 150 and I don't want to go higher. I'm not going to put in a market order, which is an aggressive order, which is going to fill me on the offer. I'm going to put up a bid, a resting bid or something like that, a limit order. So that's the traditional, you know, central limit order book model. Everyone, you know, is familiar with that. They use it on CME. They use it everywhere. But there's a crypto primitive called an automated market maker in which there is just a pool of resting liquidity sitting there to be used. And the price of which you trade these assets is mathematically based on a model. And basically why this is so cool and so fascinating is because there's just a pool of resting liquidity sitting there. And you can pretty much just use that to buy and sell into assets. And you're not actually like facing another counterparty. You're not facing someone sitting there with a resting offer or a resting bid and waiting for a match. You're literally just trading against a pool of liquidity that's sitting there. And that pool of liquidity is provided by users of the protocol. And the users of the protocol are incentivized to provide that liquidity by getting back exchange tokens, which give you a cut of the fees. And you'll see that DeFi is all very much so about how to incentivize users to actually use the stuff, right? Because it's a very novel and interesting idea. Unless there's incentives, sometimes people just aren't going to use it. Uniswap would be the coolest just because you can switch the Ethereum to whatever you want. And it doesn't have to have like a big order book or anything like that. It's a DeFi primitive is what they call it. Because nothing like it exists.
I understood everything up until you explained how we got people to facilitate the central pool of liquidity, but I don't want to make you belabor the point. I'm curious, though. We think about the traditional financial markets as far as end users, right? Hedgers and speculators. And obviously, the total notional outstanding for the derivative world so massively, inconceivably outstrips the amount of conventional underlying that's used by the real world end users. It seems like this must be orders of magnitude even beyond that as far as the ratio of speculators versus end users in these currencies, right? I mean, some of these currencies probably have never been used by an end user. Everything's just exclusively in derivative form. So who is playing in this world and what's driving the fundamentals? Like when you're thinking about, do I buy crypto? Do I sell crypto? Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's driving?
Do I buy Bitcoin? Do I sell? Do I buy Ether?
Right. There's relative value. Yeah. But I even wanted to talk about driving the macro trends, right? Up or down. What kind of fundamental analysis are you doing to get to the macro view when things aren't driven by end users as much?
Yep. Good question. So there's a couple of different points. The first one to highlight as well is obviously you guys have seen the hedging flows that come from maybe like physical oil. People need to take delivery. There's a physical product, stuff like that. Crypto doesn't really have that, right? But there is one use case and one end user who actually does have very similar product flows to those oil producers. And that would be the Bitcoin miners. That would be the people who are actually mining the Bitcoin with their, you know, GPUs, and they have their whole farm there. They're actually mining the Bitcoin. That's actually one use case where you can tie a tangible value to it because it's using electricity. So whatever the cost of the electricity was to mine that Bitcoin, they are like, oh, okay, it costs us, you know, 9,000 per Bitcoin. Bitcoin's trading at 27K. Cool. If Bitcoin goes up, we're obviously still making money. This is great. But if Bitcoin goes down and the cost of electricity is still the same, well, it would be nice if we had some sort of structured product flows or some sort of hedging flows that we can implement to use here. So that is actually one
short Bitcoin to hedge there. Okay.
Exactly. Yep. So that is actually one use case where it looks really analogous to the hedging flows of oil producers because they're just Bitcoin producers, right? And they're still tied to the price of the underlying, but it would be nice to be hedged against that. So, you know, one of the different clients we saw on our desk was those Bitcoin miners. They're like, hey, can we get an option structure here? Can we sell maybe some upside to get some cheaper downside here? That was one of the fundamental flows where it does make sense because there is literally an electricity cost. Now going off the speculator, where now we're just, you know, we want to speculate on price. We're not miners. We don't care. There's no tangible, you know, anything here. I like to think of Bitcoin as the riskiest risk asset. So any environment in which risk assets perform well, I would like to say that Bitcoin analogously will perform well, if not a little better. And you kind of saw that during the recovery in COVID, and you see that in a lot of the speculative flows. Whenever people are trading Bitcoin on the institutional side, I obviously was on the other end of that being an OTC trader, as we discussed. They still traded the FOMC. They still traded CPI. They traded the normal macro events. They just used Bitcoin and Bitcoin options as a proxy to maybe some less risky risk assets. Like instead of trading like the indexes or something like that, they're like, oh, we'll trade, you know, some at the money straddles on Bitcoin right before FOMC. We think there's going to be a lot of volatility. And it's also important to note that liquidity in these derivatives markets for Bitcoin, a couple of years ago, they're like, okay, is there even a market for this? Like, is there an institutionally large enough market to where a large hedge fund that everyone knows, can they put on size? Like, can they actually use this as an opportunity to trade? And that liquidity does exist. It's just overseas. The CME is actually not very liquid for Bitcoin options. Mm-hmm. There's a whole nother venue called Deribit, but I'll cover that later.
So really dumb question from a macro standpoint, talking about Bitcoin as digital gold, and you think about the very traditional theory of how gold is supposed to behave in risk on, risk off moves. Why is buying Bitcoin or buying one of these digital currencies an expression of risk on? If I'm worried about, you know, the integrity of the traditional banking system, I'm going to be in a risk off move, right? Yeah. And a flight to quality move. And I'm curious how that translates. It sounds a little counterintuitive.
Yep. I think that because now as the markets have evolved, that thought process of the digital gold narrative has shifted more towards the technology aspect of Bitcoin. Now a lot more people, I feel like, have moved on from, digital gold, store of value, safer asset, to this is now exposure to the next generation of technology. And I've seen that definitely.
I don't understand this stuff. It seems super risky. If I'm doing a risk on move, let's buy this crazy shit. I don't understand. That's how we're going about it, not digital gold.
Yep.
Understood.
Yep. So, but that it's definitely, you've seen the difference in people's interest in trading Bitcoin from 2013 to 2017 to 2020. 2020 is kind of whenever it took on that more riskier risk asset, because you started to see all of these decentralized applications. You started to actually see, wait, this is a next generation technology as well. Decentralized application, decentralized primitives, these are crazy. So you start to see a lot more people get exposed to it from a technology standpoint rather than just the store of value. But that store of value has always been kind of just in the back of people's minds, because it's always been the day one narrative for Bitcoin. It's just slowly started to have a shift.
So one question actually I have is, do you know what the breakdown of the institutional versus like retail is? It, because I would have thought that it's like massively more retail, although it's now, I would assume, starting to shift, especially with the ETF. And I know where to get into that, but I'm just curious, like at this point, do you have any data points on the breakdown of the investors?
Depends on the type of cryptos people are trading. So if you see someone trading Dogecoin and Shiba and meme coins, that is definitely not going to be a Goldman or a Brevin Howard or anyone doing that. But if you see, hey, can you give me, you know, 500K Vega notional at the money straddles for Bitcoin options, that's going to be the institution. So if you see the Bitcoin and the ETH, I would say that that is heavily institutionalized now, because the derivatives market for Bitcoin and ETH is just so liquid and so interesting that now the macro guys and the traditional people can actually trade this with a hedge. Because, you know, whenever you're actually trading this stuff from an institutional side, the first question is, how do I hedge this? And can I hedge this? And yeah. Bitcoin and ETH, you can do so. Shiba Inu, very difficult to do so.
I love that.
Question two. I mean, you were talking about like the cost and the electricity. And I think that I've heard anecdotes that to mine Bitcoin, it's the amount of electricity that you need to like run entire countries. In this world of obviously people being very concerned about the environment, that doesn't seem to be awesome.
Yep.
Are there other coins that are less energy intensive?
Yep.
Or like, is there a way that Bitcoin can move to not doing that?
So Bitcoin will always stay like that. And that is in a consensus mechanism called proof of work. And the consensus mechanism is how the transactions on the chain are actually validated and verified. So whenever all these transactions go through and a Bitcoin block is created, that computer is solving all the transactions. And after it finishes it, then the block gets created, stuff like that. But to your point, Ethereum, there used to be Ethereum miners as well using massive amounts of energy, and they have the same consensus mechanism, proof of work. In 2022, or it might have been 2023, I should probably be exact, ETH transitioned from their consensus mechanism being proof of work to where they had to use a bunch of electricity and mine to actually, I don't know why I keep doing physical mining. It's all on a computer. They transitioned from a consensus mechanism that was focused on the proof of work, so the mining and the computational algorithms, to something called proof of stake. And that is an entirely different consensus mechanism that is a lot less energy intensive, because what you're describing is actually something that has popped up all over 2021, all over 2022. I remember a big story was in El Salvador, whenever they were going to use Bitcoin miners, they were actually trying to use the like renewable energy source from a volcano to power their Bitcoin miners instead of like actually using, you know, electricity that is not as, I guess, clean. Because then also like from a ESG standpoint, people are like, okay, well, if the energy came from a volcano and it was renewable, is there going to be like volcano mined Bitcoin that we can buy that we can pay more for? So the concern has always been there, but also I'm not like a Bitcoin expert, more so a crypto generalist. And I know that there are Bitcoin experts who could probably give a lot more of an in-depth application for why the energy usage for Bitcoin is actually a little bit different. I know there's always been the analogs of like, hey, how much does it cost to run an entire financial system in the traditional world from an electricity perspective? And this is what Bitcoin is going to do for the new financial system. And they start to make analogs to like how big the impact can be and all that stuff. Uh-huh. But I feel like that's just, you know, it uses a lot of energy.
Got it. This is also fascinating. Chris, would you be kind enough to walk us through a trade you've put on in the past, from genesis and inception of how you came up with the trade idea to the mechanics of expressing it, whether it's a macro expression, a relative value trade? what does a trade actually look like other than like buy Bitcoin, right? Like,
I'll do you one better. I'll give you one from a retail perspective and then one from an institutional perspective. So we can talk a little bit about the thought process and in the greater fool's theory and all this stuff. So the TLDR for the retail focused trades, a lot of the retail focused trades, they've obviously seen the 1000Xs, the 100Xs, and they've seen that you can do this without derivatives. So you see a lot of people start getting interested in all these next shitcoins and meme coins. And that's right. Not like a weird way of saying it. That is literally what they refer to it in right. Even the institutional realm, shitcoins and meme coins. From a retail perspective, obviously probably the biggest one in 2022 and a while back would have been Dogecoin. Yep. That's probably one that was very massive.
Well, because I feel like I remember Elon Musk, was it on SNL? And he was like Dogecoin to the moon. And then it was this huge. Yeah,
exactly. So that's kind of like a more retail oriented trade idea from a just directional only. I'm taking a narrative bet or I'm just speculating. My fiance's brother actually bought Doge at like 2 cents or whatever. And his thought process was very momentum driven. And that's a lot of what the retail trade thesis kind of looks like is, oh, it's going up. I want to get in right now. FOMO. If it's going up, it's going to keep going up. It's very momentum driven. And you'll start to see from the retail perspective as well, once that momentum dies out, once the trading volume goes down, they get, you know, in crypto, it's called you get caught holding the bag. You just have a bag of nothing. Right?
That's what it's called in traditional finance.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, so you just get caught holding a bag. Like once the volume dies out, once the momentum dies out, you get caught holding the bag because in crypto, like you're talking about, for a lot of these coins, there's not really like a fundamental use case or a fundamental narrative.
There's no one to take the other side when
exactly. Like if you have like, you know, the company went down 90% or something and you're caught holding the bag, whatever. Well, maybe in a year they come out with an earnings report that says, oh, hey, we actually have recovered, or hey, we're going to release this new thing and it's going to be awesome again. Whereas the meme coin, they don't really have a lot of opportunities to be like, hey, we changed everything up. We're good to go again. It's just a picture of a dog.
Yeah.
All over. Also, you have correct me if I'm wrong, in these shit coins and meme coins, you don't have market makers whose entire job is to maintain an orderly liquid market. It's not like you've got a treasury desk at every single bank across the street willing to make two ways on everything, right?
Yep. Good point. And that's actually, it goes back into why the exchange I was talking about earlier, Uniswap, the decentralized exchanges, their role to play in this ecosystem, because there is some liquidity on the decentralized exchanges. And that's kind of where people go in and out for some of these shitcoins. But that was kind of my perspective from a retail-oriented mindset. It's very momentum-driven. It is very, you have to be in and out quickly because there's no fundamental thesis that in 5 years, Dogecoin is going to have the cutest dog, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you can't really think like that. And then from the institutional perspective, it gets very centric and focused on Bitcoin and Ethereum. And the reason for that is because they have the most liquid derivatives markets. So from the institutional standpoint, the immediate first question I'm asking is, where can I go to hedge this out? Is there a liquid options market for me to actually take some sort of interesting trade on volatility? Can I do this delta neutral? So from the institutional standpoint, I guess from the retail standpoint, one of my trades was like Dogecoin and stuff, or it was also Ripple in 2017, but it was very momentum focused, very much so, you know, FOMO type aspect. But from the institutional standpoint, there were still the aspects of kind of like momentum and positive price movement, but we also have access to a very liquid derivatives market in the options space here for crypto, and we can take bets specifically on volatility. So one of the trades that I had put on January 2023. So this was a month after FTX. This was right whenever everything blew up. This was right whenever everyone was giving up on crypto. And it also coincided with the holiday season. So everyone's off skiing and stuff. Exactly. Liquidity is very thin in the holidays, blah, blah, blah. We get back 2 weeks into January. Bitcoin's at 16 or 17K. From my perspective, I'm really thinking like, hey, you know, price action wise, this just seems kind of like a bottom. And it wasn't just a gut feeling. It was more so analyzing historical data. So this approach was a lot more quantitative, a lot more focused on historical data. I'm taking looks at what
DeMarc indicators. Are you looking at technical data like that? Or is this just an overall like, hey, here, you know, we got up to whatever it was, and now we're at 16. Like this is
mainly price and volume, because that's also one thing to focus on as well. It's not like I'm investing in a company that has a cash flow or anything like that. these markets do get pretty technically driven, but that's not, I never really put any trades on based on technical analysis. It's kind of like, I don't know, astrology for men, I would say. It's
That is a good soundbite. I can't wait to use that. But wait, how do you measure volume? Like, because there's no, like open interest, is there? Like, how does it work?
So there's like aggregated volume across a bunch of the centralized exchanges. So I can be like, oh, I look at Coinbase and, you know, this week they traded 1,500 Bitcoin, or, you know, this week heading into the end of the year, it was like 200 or something like that. So a bunch of data aggregation sources. I take a look at volume. I take a look at open interest in the options markets. Those are actually very developed.
Okay, I didn't know that.
So they, it's very developed there.
So you can see. You're looking at it just like a treasury futures trader would.
Yep. So I'm looking at the open interest. I'm taking a look at what's going on in the options market. I mean, the trade that I ended up putting on was kind of like a trade that was focused on both a directional move as well as kind of taking a bet on volatility. So one of the more interesting things that was going on in the middle of December was it was like down in the dumps. Like Bitcoin was 16.7K, implied volatility after the crash for like FTX was massive initially, but kind of like slowly started to fade.
You bought call options?
Yeah. So just kind of bought some call options expiring early February. And those ended up playing out decently well, because obviously whenever you're buying a call, like you have, you know, the directional exposure and the volatility exposure. And Bitcoin second week of January did end up kind of breaking out back higher. And it was based on a macro trend, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure it was either, you know, FOMC minutes or CPI that came out, but it was something positive for Bitcoin. And you started to see a rally. You started to be like, oh, wow, Bitcoin's actually moving again. So implied volatility for these options also went up. So it was kind of like a double win. It was, I won on direction, I won on volatility. But it's cool because Bitcoin and Ethereum have like a very liquid derivatives market for people to actually put these trades on. So there are people, you know, trading risk reversals, trading flies, they're taking some complex bets, they're taking hedging bets.
Yeah, I just want to say for any listener who might not be as familiar with some of the option stuff, in general, calls, puts, their options, and if you think about what the drivers are that go into the valuation, there's different models you can use to understand what the value of that option is. Usually it's Black-Scholes or whatever. There's like these crazy Monte Carlo simulations you can do. But basically the price movement, that's the volatility more or less. And the higher the volatility, the higher the value of the option. So you were, again, making money on the fact that there was a lot of movement in the price. And so I just wanted to connect those dots in case someone's listening and is like, wait a second. I don't know anything about even traditional options. So because we are going to have an episode on options, but it hasn't come out yet. So.
Got it. Yeah. Well, and then actually one of the more recent trades with the Bitcoin ETF. So this was actually a trade when volatility was a lot higher. So I got lucky, you know, January 2023, because volatility was low. So I was like, oh, these call options are super cheap anyways. Volatility is low. Maybe I'll just buy some. And hopefully if the event plays out, like it does well, whatever. But, you know, one of my favorite trades to put on whenever volatility is relatively high is just call spreads, right? You know, if I'm buying an option with high implied vol, I at least get to sell one. And I still get that directional exposure as well. So that was one of the trades that I talked about on Twitter and put on for the ETF. It was like, hey, I'm going to buy the 40K call, sell the 45. If it ends up above 45, like, good.
I always used to explain it to people as with the call spread, you're buying the call option and then you're financing part of the premium you have to pay by selling the higher call. So your upside is capped, but you still can make money in the movement from, in your example, going from 40,000 to 45,000.
Yep.
You just talked about the role of the collapse of FTX in terms of the market implications that that had for the cryptocurrency space. Can you talk about what the impacts of that were and how that's playing out now as far as the overall structure of that market, you know, the regulatory environment and the general perception of this thing that went from this is the Wild West to, hey, maybe there is an orderly way to do this, to like, ah, no, crypto's bad. It's all criminals, blah, 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 blah. Where do you think we are in that cycle right now? And where do you see us going?
I think that we are now in a very institutionalized point of the cycle, especially whenever players like BlackRock, Fidelity, Goldman, whenever these players all start getting into the space, they do it in a very prim and proper way. They're going to do it correctly. Whenever FTX happened, it just highlighted exactly as you're saying, it really was kind of the Wild West in terms of the regulatory aspects and things like that. And after that kind of happened, you started to see a lot of crackdowns and a lot more highlighting bad actors in the space. Obviously, it was very terrible for that to happen, but how the space has evolved since then has been very positive, I would say, from this is now an asset class that institutions can start to think about adopting. And then obviously with the ETF, that has now started to happen. From my perspective, the ETF brings in a different investor as well. So I mean, as soon as I think about the ETF, I immediately think like, oh, my parents are going to have this in their 401k and they don't even have to know now. They'll be like, hey, you know, wealth management, hey, allocate 1% towards Bitcoin, buy some shares. Super easy. So that's something I like to think about now. They bring in kind of like a different investor, but it also just brings in so much more capital in the space. When more capital comes into the space, markets get more liquid. When markets get more liquid, more institutions get interested because now they have more liquid access to derivatives. Now they get access to more volume and more trading fees from the market maker perspective. More capital in the space just kind of is very positive. And then also, like I was saying, these are traditional institutions who have been around for dozens, hundreds of years. They know what they're doing. I have big faith in their legal teams. And although I am not a lawyer, I have faith in their lawyers. So I feel like they know what they're doing.
So one question, actually, as this becomes more mainstream, right? I feel like one of the things that people are probably going to start asking, who are the main players in the crypto space? In the sense of, you think about the big names in investment banks, it's the Goldman, Morgan, JP Morgan, right? Or you look at venture capital firms, look at the private equity firms. Who is the almost like Harvard, Princeton, Yale of the crypto firms, or any that you think are interesting for people to keep an eye out? Because it is such a new space that like you could have someone who, all right, like they might be up and coming and become the Goldman. So I'm just,
do you mean on the dealer side or the investment side?
Both.
No, I've got a big competitive landscape knowledge here. So I can talk about the venture side, the market makers, the OTC desks, and then also the exchanges would probably be good to highlight. So, kind of just talking about the exchanges, obviously the big ones in the US are going to be Coinbase and Kraken. Those are going to be two of the large US exchanges that I know of. Obviously, Binance, KuCoin, OKX. These are all overseas exchanges, but those are relatively popular with their own user bases there. And then the biggest options exchange, which has 90% plus of the market share, is actually not based in the US. They're based in Dubai. They used to be based in Panama. It's Deribit. So Deribit Exchange is the crypto options exchange that has 90%+ market share across Bitcoin and ETH. They've been in the space for quite some time now. They had first mover advantage and just really kept it. They have favorable like lending, borrowing, margining. They're tied into every OTC liquidity providing platform. They came into the space early, came in quickly, and just built their reputation as being the options exchange for crypto. And liquidity never really pulled away.
One quick question. Are there still limits on how much US-based investors can do in this space? And is that one of the reasons why so many of the exchanges are overseas?
Great question. So Deribit actually is not accessible to US customers. So I can't actually trade on Deribit. And that is actually a massive thing. And that is why I also think that the ETF is going to be very, very interesting. Because from the US perspective, all the US maybe retail or institutions who didn't want to trade overseas on Deribit, didn't want to have to deal with regulatory and compliance talks. Now they get access to what seemingly should be a liquid crypto vol market through the ETF as a proxy. Just trade options on IBIT or something like that. So I think that that will be very interesting. But you're absolutely correct. US customers are still very limited in terms of what they can access. And then the derivatives regulation in terms of futures, US customers, I think, are also very, very limited as well, which is also why decentralized applications and decentralized exchanges is interesting, but maybe not for the right reasons, because you don't actually have to KYC or go through some of the things for decentralized exchanges, and you can get access.
Anti-money laundering.
Got it.
Okay, sorry.
Exchanges.
Yep. So those are the spot and futures exchanges, as well as the one big options exchange. I would say for like very large OTC desks, you can kind of split them into the crypto native OTC desks that have only crypto background, and then maybe the desks that are the traditional desks that have crypto arms now and have built that out. The largest crypto native ones, it actually is a nice acronym. It was like the three G's, Galaxy, Genesis, and GSR. I would say that those were some of the large like institutional crypto desks that focused on both the prime brokerage. They focused on offering a wide variety of different services, OTC, market making, all that. Now a lot of the traditional firms are starting to get in the space. Cumberland DRW. So Cumberland is the crypto arm of DRW that's been around since 2013. DRW is obviously massively known in the space. They have a massive presence in the crypto space. They do everything correctly. And then kind of like Flow Traders, they're a big ETF market maker and participant there, very active in crypto. And then from what I've seen, it just seems like a couple of firms are starting to dip their toes into it. So Acuna Capital had a crypto options team as well. But all the traditional firms now have crypto on their radar, and whether or not they believe in them, you know, whether or not they believe in crypto. So I'm sure everyone keeps seeing the posts about Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan and how he's like, oh, you know, I hate crypto, but if people want to trade it, we'll let you trade it. So yeah, whether or not they like it, it's whatever. And then I'd also say from a crypto native side on the options trading as well, QCP Capital in Singapore. They're a very big one as well. And then from the venture and investment side, Coinbase is going to be a big one. They have a Coinbase Ventures team. Pantera Capital. Pantera is going to be a very big one. A16Z Crypto. So it's just A16Z, but they have the crypto spinoff of it as well. Those would be very big ones off the top of my head. Oh, and then, yeah, the market making as well. These are firms that specifically focus on market making for these tokens, but also have like OTC and stuff like that, but they're known as market makers. GSR, my old firm, and then Wintermute, those would be two very, very large token market makers. And then a firm called Flow Desk, which is different than Flow Traders.
This is helpful because, again, it's like one of these things where I think especially even like when I was coming in to this whole finance space, it was like, I've heard of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. And actually, even before then, I don't even think I'd heard of them. But at some point, I was like, okay, I know who they are. And then it's like, okay, now I need to like know who Blackstone is. Okay, now I need to know Brevan Howard or like Citadel. Yep. And it's like just for people to start hear these names and like if you're reading about crypto and they have the name of some institution that you've never heard of before, it's like, hopefully helping to kind of place where they are. Because even Jen was like, yep. You talk broker dealer, you talk about, and I'm like, I have no idea what I'm talking about. I just need a picture of the landscape.
And speaking of reading about crypto, I have no idea what kind of formal learning resources are there out there. Like you said, there is no crypto major, right? Mm-hmm. What are the reputable, whether it be publications or learning modules? How does one get up to speed other than watching TikTok videos? And we're going to talk about TikTok after this, but I'm curious to know, like, what's the Fabozzi's handbook of fixed income securities of the crypto space?
Yep. So one thing I'd recommend right off the bat, it's actually by Binance. They have an education thing. So you can Google Binance Academy and it actually covers everything from just, oh, what's Bitcoin to what is a consensus mechanism? How I was describing earlier, proof of work versus proof of stake to, you know, what is a decentralized application? What is a layer one? What is a layer two? It's really pretty good.
Free, and
it's
free or is that
course
that people have?
All free.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, the thing about crypto is like all the information is out there. It's just, how do I find it? So just having someone tell you where it is.
Chaff,
exactly.
Right? Because again, you're an actual crypto expert, but for every Chris Newhouse out there, there's 10 other crypto traders, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, pretending to be experts.
They're being an expert is basically like buy Dogecoin. And it's like, buy Dogecoin so that I can make money and you know, you're the type thing.
So I'd say Binance Academy is a good one. And then some of the crypto native research firms. So these firms are research firms specifically focused on talking about the narratives or the technical concepts or stuff like that. That would be, so some of these are paid. I don't use a lot of them anymore, but some of them are paid. That would be Messari, Delphi Digital, Blockworks. That's another good research firm. These are all like very formalized. They literally are hiring research analysts with like very technical backgrounds to write this stuff. It's good stuff. And then looking at some of the VCs love being thought leaders. So they're putting out, you know, thought leadership pieces on what's the next narrative and stuff like that. That's actually something that I'm writing right now for Cumberland Labs. I'm putting out a bunch of different research pieces. And then also Twitter is actually very, very, very big in crypto. But that's one where you really need to figure out who you're following and who's saying what. Because either you're following, you know, the head of research at Delphi Digital or you're following some anonymous person with a dog profile picture and you don't know what they're saying.
Exactly.
So Twitter is very, very big. It comes down to kind of like the ethos of social media as well. And what you'll see is it's very hard because it's not like serious writing. It might be someone just putting out 140 characters on the next narratives, or it might be like you click on it and it's a deep dive Twitter thread, but it's not really formalized. It's like the tone is very not research focused. It's more casual, which is why sometimes it's just really hard to suss out whether or not it's actually beneficial, because it's not a formalized academic tone. It's crypto native memes, all this stuff.
Yeah. Are you on Twitter or X? Like, can we follow you?
Yeah. On Twitter, my name is @CryptoDefiGuy. So just crypto DeFi guy. As soon as I joined Genesis, the first thing, you know, one of the sales guys said to me was like, all right, you have to be on Twitter. Like, everything in crypto happens on Twitter. You have to get on this. And this was a guy who, you know, had been at CME for 12 years. So he was really embracing the crypto culture as well. But yeah, I got to be on Twitter. And I was like, okay, what's like the most crypto sounding name? Crypto DeFi guy. Kind of like crypto trader 321. I was like,
But so speaking of the Twitter sphere and all of these people talking about crypto, I would love to get into here a little bit of the crypto culture and the perception, whether it be on social media, in the mainstream media, our exposure to it, whether it be on TikTok, Instagram, all those things. I think there's a very well-established stereotype of the crypto bro, and we don't see a ton of at least visibility of women in the space. And if they're there, it's the crypto babe, right? It's a woman, effectively, it seems, being used to lure in retail investors into the Dogecoin, et cetera, et cetera. Can you talk about, though, what that's actually like in reality for the sophisticated crypto traders? Because I imagine, just like it is with traditional finance, there's a schism between what the lived reality is of being in high finance and the fin meme space where everyone's a finance bro and everyone's toxic. That's not what it's like in real life, right? Yeah. What is it actually like in real life? And what do you think is responsible for the preponderance of this stereotype?
Yep. So I think it's really split into the institutional and professional side, like you're saying, and then what's funny on TikTok, what gets views, and what people are going to watch. This, like, there's always been the, I always call them like the Forex gurus, the people on Instagram who just sell a Forex course or like, here's how you trade, I made $1 million. There are always going to be those kind of people because it's always going to get views. As soon as someone's like, oh, this guy made $1 million in a week, I'm signing up for his course. Like,
oh my God, no, do not trust those people.
Don't do that.
They happen to get randomly lucky, and that's not going to happen to you.
Or they didn't, or they were fronted $1 million worth of exposure, not actually $1 million worth of cash to trade options, and they got a payout of $2,500 of making money for someone else.
Yep, exactly. So, and that's like very big in crypto as well. So I guess I'll cover, the perspective of kind of like what the crypto culture looks like on the professional institutional side, what it looks like for women in that space, and then I'll cover what it kind of looks like not professionally, I guess, as well, just from being on both sides, retail and institutional. So on the institutional and professional side here, like from my perspective, the firms that I have always been associated with have been started by people from traditional finance. The GSR was started by multiple ex-Goldman guys, like our legal and CTR from Citadel. It's a very, prim and proper firm. They focus a lot on the regulatory front, but I was also a trader there. So obviously trader culture is also different than everything else. I actually loved my team. It was awesome. We had, great work-life balance, which is something you probably wouldn't hear in the traditional space. I had an awesome manager. He was previously from Citadel as well, like encouraged me to take time off, which was crazy. From what I've heard, from people in banking and sales and trading, like, hey, you just started, don't take time off. You have to be working all the time. And then also like the two younger people on my team as well came from traditional finance, SIG and Barclays. Awesome. I love the team. It was great. And then even with my internship, like the thing is as well, from what I've experienced in professionals in this space and something that I try to do myself is that everyone who I reached out to as a student in crypto, 80% of those people took my calls or they were interested in talking to me. And maybe that's because I interned obviously at a very good place and they were curious about what it looked like there. But everyone was very accommodating to get people into the space. It was like they were happy to talk about crypto. Maybe that was like the secondary, wanting some like bias for, hey, I got into crypto, please, we need to get more people in. but from my perspective, everyone was just very friendly. Every time a student reaches out to me for crypto, I try to do what they did for me. As soon as I experienced that culture, I was like, okay, I want to keep perpetuating this. Like, this is good. From everything I've heard in sales and trading and investment banking, or maybe, the hedge fund buy side, they're working 70-hour weeks, all this stuff. I just really like the culture in crypto. And you'll actually see that across a variety of the different crypto like subsectors. So I was in the trading and market making side, very traditional firm, you know, very good culture there. But you also start to see like very laid back culture and stuff, more so associated with tech than finance, even though I was at more of a finance oriented firm. And then I guess from the women perspective, obviously, I'm not a woman. I would like to say that it is a lot more encouraging and opening than from what I could have seen. And I'm not just saying that. And I think that is kind of my role to like be very transparent and honest here. My fiance is a chemical engineer from Georgia Tech. All of her internships, she was just surrounded by men. So, I mean, I'm being very transparent that I do think that it is very open and encompassing. I mean, honestly, if I start thinking about it, I can actually probably name more of the successful women who are in this space than men, honestly. I actually can. I can name three founders off the top of my head who have founded decentralized derivatives protocols that have raised. I can name, you know, a head of sales who is now Forbes 30 under 30, co-founder of another decentralized prime broker. Maybe it's also just the people I try to surround myself with in the space. I guess it also is important to highlight as well, like the variety of roles that they're in. It's not just marketing. It's not just one specific role. I've met co-founders, developers, sales, trading. So I'm actually going to ETH Denver, which is a very large conference in Denver. Yeah. And one of the things that they have on their panel speakers is they have something called No Manals. So it's not, it just can't be a panel full of men. So it's like, it's very encouraging from what I have seen in my perspective that it is very open.
That's awesome to hear. You know, that again, that the public perception, and by the public, I mean the dregs of social media where I see most of this stuff, have nothing to do with reality.
But I do think it might, I do think sometimes though, what people see on social media influences what women want to do, right? So if your whole understanding of the crypto space is what you see on social media, the memes, the just kind of grossness. I mean, but it's probably the same with finance too. I mean, like you see a lot in traditional finance. And that's actually one of the reasons we wanted to start our account, was because we wanted to put stuff out there that was more, I don't know,
inclusive,
encouraging, and less just like looks, you know? But I do think that sometimes it's one of those things where people, it's like these subtle cues, right? They actually can influence how people behave. And so, you know, I do wonder if, you know, there was just a little bit more of a female presence in the crypto online space that would potentially translate into, I mean, probably not, but like, I don't know. I mean, I wonder.
The fact of the matter is it's hard because the institutional and the professional side is very different from social media. But exactly as you're saying, people who are in these kind of like, you know, me just like scrolling on TikTok and finding your channel, if all I see is a bunch of like shitcoin scamming like stuff going on Twitter, like I'm gonna start thinking like, is this actually a career I can pursue? And I'm just not even gonna think to research and do my diligence on what the career path actually looks like if this is all I see. So unfortunately, a lot of that happens. And I just don't think that it'll ever stop because, first of all, a lot of that is, as you're saying, it's promoting shitcoins or promoting all these things or kind of like using that to promote something for monetary gain. So the fact of the matter is if someone's making money off it, they're just going to keep doing it. They're going to keep posting. If it keeps getting views, keeps getting likes, no matter what or how bad it is, they're just going to keep doing it.
You do definitely see it more in the crypto space for whatever reason, but I guess it's also in the actual.
I think it's
in the crypto space because people don't understand it, right? And they're just looking for someone to tell them a direction. And again, this sounds insane to me as an elder millennial to listen to someone on the internet telling you to do something and you'll make $1 million. But when you don't have one resounding source of information like we used to, information is so decentralized. Sure, I don't know. Here's someone who looks like they're rich telling me they got rich by doing something. If I don't know any better, I might follow along.
And the biggest thing as well is in crypto, like if you're doing it in the real markets, like you can't just IPO. You can't just do that. But in crypto, you can just make a coin. And you can just go put it out there. Like seriously, whenever you get into the cryptography and stuff, it's just like, oh, I can just spin up a new shitcoin on Solana like that. And then now it's just a bunch of like random memes or a bunch of political stuff that kind of pops up. And 5 seconds later, you might see like a shitcoin related to that meme just pop up on Solana. And people are like going and buying it just because they think they can dump it on someone else later. Oh, it's like, it can be that quick.
Yeah. And I mean, and then there's like the whole NFT space, which I still don't understand. Like the NFT.
Yeah.
Like that's a whole other layer.
Neither do I.
The same idea where it's like,
they do seem to go hand in hand though, that everyone thinks about crypto and NFT as like part and parcel of the same business model.
Yeah. But the NFT stuff, I get half of it and half I don't, because half of it, I do see why people buy this. Like, why do people buy like these designer purses or, you know, super fast cars or things like that? And it's just to like flex to other people. That's literally what the NFTs are. The reason people buy Pudgy Penguin number 5 for $40K is because they get to say that they have a Pudgy Penguin and nobody else does.
It's artificial scarcity, right?
Yes, like, yes, so, yes.
Again, I understand distilling an idea down to its purest form, but I'm not sure that the NFT is it.
Yeah. A couple of my friends in 2022 got in through NFTs, whereas I got in through trading it. So it's very different.
Everyone has their, like, gateway drug. Like.
Yeah. Like 2022 NFTs. Yeah.
Oh, God.
So funny.
Chris, this has been amazing. I would say that I understood like 3% of what you said, and that's doubled my crypto understanding since we started. Hopefully we can have you back on. I think that this is worthy of future touches in the space.
By the way, I was so excited to hear that your fiance is a chemical engineer. Jen's best friend is a chemical engineer. Chemical engineering. I love the engineering stuff.
Like, yeah, her entire family was in finance, so she was the black sheep of the group. So she did engineering, but love it. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. Funny. Well, congratulations again on all your success and on your upcoming wedding, which I'm crashing this summer. we're so glad to have you on. Thank you so much
again. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for listening to The Wall Street Skinny. We are more than just a podcast, so follow us on TikTok and Instagram at The Wall Street Skinny. If you're a visual learner, we have content that will help get you up the curve from valuation to Excel to bond fundamentals 101. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, where we will be publishing in-depth tutorials on all this and more.